Welcome to Live from My Office. Got a special one today. A guy that never does interviews and was one of the founding partners for Jam Productions. Jam Productions preceded Live Nations, preceded Ticketmaster, and put together every major show. Now, I mean, not just in Chicago, everywhere. And a few years ago, Arnie left Jam, and he's doing all sorts of cool things now. But great stories, including an Elton John story you got to hear about a ticketing problem. He also has some pretty strong opinions on how ticketing is done now and how we're all being taken to the cleaners with service fees. But anyway, very cool to talk to the great Arnie Granite. Now, I'm live from my office. So, Arnie, let's do a little history, if you don't mind, because it's so kind of you to do this and take the time to talk. I know it's not your favorite thing to do. You like talking about other people. But if I go all the way backwards and you don't become one of the preeminent music promoters of all time, along with Jerry through the years, obviously, and now what you're doing, what would you have done? What would your life have been?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know because I never had the opportunity. You know, I was 22 when I came back to Chicago from college. I jumped right into the business. Jerry and I at that time just formed Jam. And I can tell you how we named it. People always want to know what Jam stands for, or what it was. But we started security guards at the Aragon Ballroom in 1972. And there were different promoters then. We were not promoters. And the promoter at that time named Jan Wynn at the Aragon went bust. And we went to the owners of the Aragon and we said, we know this building. We've been the security people and we want to promote. And we were there for 35 years.
That's the backstory, I think, is interesting, too. My old friend and yours, Rick Kogan, told me that your dads knew each other.
My dad and his dad played gin every Friday with six other guys. And his dad was our lawyer, and his dad and my dad talked when I was in Chicago and Jerry was at Ohio State. I'm 3 years older than Jerry. And he said, well, his father says, my son's really interested in music. Maybe him and Arnie should talk. So in those days, we met, Jerry and I, over not a Zoom, they didn't have them, a conference call with the big box, you know, you'd hear.
Sure.
Hello,
sure.
Are you there? And right. That's how we met. And we became partners on a phone call.
Did you like each other right away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did. And we lived together. We didn't have any money, so we lived together the first years in two different places when we started Jam.
You offered Jam as a definition. What does Jam stand for?
This is the question I'm going to tell you so you know whether maybe the people find this interesting. The way the name Jam came about was this. What the fuck should we call this company? He looks at me and goes, let's just call it Blue Sky Productions. I went, that sucks. Let's call it something musical like Jam.
That's okay. Fantastic.
And we could change it later. Now, people ask, what does it stand for? Well, I'll tell you what it doesn't stand for. It doesn't stand for Jewish American Mafia. It doesn't stand for Jerry and Arnie's money because we didn't have any. And he had a girl, Michelle, and it didn't stand for that either. It was just Jam. So that was really how it started.
It's amazing. The simplest work sometimes. So there was a guy named, to the core to think there are people that don't know this, but there was a guy back in the day named Bill Graham. And Bill Graham was the West Coast promoter that everybody looked to. When you guys started Jam, did you reach out to him in any way? Did he reach out to you?
No, but actually he started on the East Coast. Fillmore East was first. Then he moved to San Francisco.
I didn't see. There you go. I didn't even know that.
He did that. And I met Bill Graham at a Billboard convention in 1972-ish when we started. And he was standing in front of me in line to get whatever passes we had to get for the conference. And I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Mr. Graham. And he goes, yeah, what do you want? I said, I just want you to know I'm going to be up your ass for the next part of your life. He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, my name's G-R-A-N and you're G-R-A-H. So I'm always the motherfucker behind you. And we became very dear friends. He was probably the most inspiring promoter producer of his time. He was an actor, and he was a superstar of promoters. And when he passed away, and I think it was a helicopter, an airplane crash, it was a big loss for the industry. But he was a unique individual.
Yeah, and the reason I bring it up is because most careers have a mentor or somebody they can look to. Promoters, it just doesn't exist. It's not somebody you can go, well, let's do it like he did it, because everybody knows how he did it. You guys really didn't have a map to follow.
No, it was in those early years. What happened was there was about 20, 30 in those days guys, because women were not part of that equation then. They are now, but they weren't then. It evolved, like everything else. And we invented what's called the concert business. In those days, there were no computers. We settled on napkins, and you take this, I take this money, you know, and it was a whole different business. And remember, when we were growing up, Steve, that music was a way of life.
Absolutely.
Today, it is not a way of life. The artist, my belief is that they had deep talent and the ability to connect with the audience. And they could put out albums, and you can listen to the whole album, not one song. And today, you know, you could be a star in 20 minutes. And that doesn't mean you have depth to go out and play a concert, you know, and they may have one or two songs, or there's a hit on TikTok or whatever you want to call whatever. And so it's a different animal today. The record companies aren't as powerful as they used to be. Social media is all powerful, as you know. And it's just a different animal today.
Yeah, the ability to be famous overnight is fascinating in a way. Driving by a car accident is fascinating, because I see comedians who become people who can sell out comedy rooms and sell out a tour who don't have 10 minutes in their act.
That's what I'm alluding to as far as other acts, musical acts. And comedy is a great example of comedy and country, things that weren't as big as rock and roll, and when rock and roll was it.
Yeah, of course.
They can sell out, some of them sell out stadiums. I'm not stadium. Yeah, stadiums, but basically, you know, the basketball and hockey arenas, yeah, as well as the theaters. It's truly amazing. And they can catch fire and build an audience much quicker than it was when we were growing up, because of what we're doing right now, how we're doing it, technically didn't exist.
And now, and the thing is, talent is not disposable. Talent lasts. The only thing that makes talent disposable is eventually if drive changes. A lightning strike lasts for a second, and that's what so much of today's talent feels like.
Good analogy.
Arnie, the thing, I don't mean to make you walk down history lane forever, but I think you have so many cool stories, you've probably forgotten 50% of them. What's the first big act you guys worked with?
It was, I know the answer right away, because I'm asked the question a lot. 1972, we first major show for us was in St. Paul, Minnesota. Okay. At the St. Paul Civic Center, which held about 16,000 people. Honestly, we probably really didn't know what we were doing, but the show was headliner Savoy Brown.
Okay.
Special guest, Fleetwood Mac. Yes. And the opening act was Long John Baldry, who had one hit. And we drove up there. We didn't know nothing about. We drove up there and, let's just say we were in a good mood driving there and back, because we sold out. And if I knew what I knew today, then I would have made more money on that show. And it was our first experience, and it was a very enlightening. And I think it just stuck with us. Wow, if we just do 10 of these a year, God, we'll be making a lot of money.
Right.
That was very real quick. In April 1, of that year, our second show was in Columbus, Ohio. Not our second major show. It was at the Veterans Memorial Auditorium, I believe. The act was Deep Purple. Special guest Buddy Miles, opening act Nazareth.
Wow.
And we came off that show. Wow, it sold out, Deep Purple. But we're wondering, why did we get Deep Purple in Columbus? They're a big act, and it's sold out in one day. But we found out why. At 4 o'clock, when there were no cell phones, someone says, come over, there's a payphone. I went to the payphone And I got a message from their group that they were canceling. They couldn't make it. I also found out the reason why we got them is the promoter of the Jam of Cleveland was a company called Belkin Productions. Okay. And they had canceled on Belkin four times, so he didn't want to do them. So that's why we got the act.
Wow.
And they canceled on us. And I go up on stage, and it's April Fool's. Imagine 4,000 Deep Purple fans sold out in the auditorium. And I'm going, well, listen, we got some good news and bad news. The bad news is that Deep Purple's not going to play. And a guy from the balcony yells, can I say what I say?
Sure, of course.
Fuck you, April's Fools. They thought I was lying. They thought I was kidding. I said, I'm talking to them. No. And it was, they start throwing things. And but the good news is Buddy Miles is going to play an extra set. Blah, blah, blah. The bottom line is half the people left. And we learned that day that it was a business. And
it could be a tough one. So in the process of doing that, you know what else amazes me? You mentioned payphones. Credit cards weren't in everybody's wallet at that point. It was a cash business. And in a cash business, how in God's name did a couple of kids manage that?
Well, maybe a good accountant. We were very, I have to say that we were very above board in this because there was a lot of cash flying around. And we never partook, or I think that's the word, in some of the things that other promoters did because we either were too afraid to get caught or thought it was the wrong thing. Just like we did indoor scalping. We were not scalpers. We fought scalping. Jerry especially fought the scalping. And an interesting fact is that we started our own ticket company or ticket. I guess it was a company you could join where we had somebody you could buy a membership for $100. And then if you had a ticket to a show, you could buy a ticket. Maybe it'd have a $10 service charge as opposed to $100, $200 they do today. And I got to tell you something, Steve. We didn't get a number of people we thought we were trying to have a service that was cool to the patron, not expensive, great seats. But they still went to the brokers and paid much more to do it. And it made us pissed, let's just say that. It was not
cool. An odd moment of human behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I want to ask you about the service charge thing as well, but the 70s in Chicago weren't the 20s in Chicago, but when you have a business that's suddenly cash rich, how did you keep the criminal element out of it? Nobody was protecting you.
We just did it right, I believe. If you go back, find some people that, company Jerry and I did either 50 years or so, 52 years, whatever it was. You don't hear much negative about Jam. You don't hear scandals.
You don't hear any negative about Jam.
And that's part of our secret sauce. Remember the saying that we came up with, brought to you with a little help from your friends at Jam.
Yeah.
And people might, but it was a subliminal thing we did. And we really, the patrons came first. And we believed that ad nauseum. And it was a part of our execution. So that's just the way it was. And I'm not saying we were angels, but I'm saying that we were closer than most.
Yeah. Well, and to be able to pull off this business in show business without that element is amazing. To be able to keep your hand up and say, no, thank you. And for them to actually stay out. So you're in your 20s. It's really starting to happen. I'm Dennis DeYoung is a friend of mine, and Styx has some great Jam stories because how much you meant to Styx. But is there, are there acts through the years that you became friendly with on a level that was helpful, or maybe it wasn't so helpful?
Well, two things. People always ask me what my favorite act is. And I say my favorite act is called Sold Out.
If it sells out, that's
my favorite act. But to answer your question, I made it a practice pretty much is, we were friends in the early days, but you have to put quotes around the word friends. Mm-hmm. The artists don't make the business decisions. The manager and the agents did. So you really had to be friends with the managers and the agents. And they were the ones who made the business decision. So, yes, we hung out with all the groups, the Journeys, the Aerosmiths, all them. We hung out with all of them and did whatever we did in those days. And It was a ride, and I'd love to share all of it with you, but I fucking can't believe I don't remember half of it. But you can imagine.
How could you? How could you? You know, Beyonce, I love Beyonce, but Beyonce travels with a videographer and a photographer because she'll forget it all someday too. You guys didn't have that.
No, no. And I don't think I would have, I don't like to photograph myself in any way, but anyway, we did not. And, wasn't part of the routine. The acts were the stars. We were the, we could never tell you what to see. We could just give you the opportunity to see it. And you have to be the judge. You know, when acts would come to me and they weren't doing well, manager, why aren't we selling tickets? I said, come with me. And I go out to the front and I point up at the marquee and have the name of the artist up there. And I point up there and says, my name ain't the fucking name up there. Your artist is. They didn't sell the tickets. Did you advertise? No. Why would I advertise? I want to lose money. Of course I advertised.
Right.
We were the go-between between the fans, the public, and the artists. We couldn't tell the artist what to play. You know, sometimes Eric Clapton did a blues show. Some of the people weren't as happy because he didn't play his hits. But, you know, Eric Clapton was, he played what he wanted. He's a superstar. And great.
How big a deal was radio in the 70s to you guys?
Well, you know, we started WXRT Radio.
I knew that. And WLS is in its 100th anniversary now, my place. And the Big 89 was just absolutely essential to rock music.
Well, we were right next door to you, you know, in WLS, yep. John Gurren and them. I just talked to John the other day. For those who don't know, John Gurren was the general manager of production. So he was the boss over at LS for a while.
Yeah. And great guy.
Great guy. And when music, the alternative music came out, God bless LS, but, you know, you played 9 songs a day and you had all these new acts out there that couldn't get who the hell knew Aerosmith, Prince, whatever. And sure. WXRT was a 24-hour Spanish-speaking station. And I went to them, and we brokered midnight to 6 a.m. That's how it started. So okay. At 11:59, they'd go, Buenas noches. And at 12:01, we hit them with Led Zeppelin. And that's how it happened. And it went down to 10 o'clock. And Jerry and I sold our shares. Probably the stupidest deal we ever did. We made like $1,200 a piece. We go, wow, we're living together. This is 3 months' rent. We make it. This, what a deal we made. And about 4 years later, they sold it for $100 million. Okay, so that wasn't our best move, but, the station was a success and it allowed us to present the music that people were listening to then outside of LS.
Right, because kids, no internet. Without music radio, the artists didn't have a major a place to expose their acts. Now they tour to expose their music. Everything is just upside down. Acts now tour to expose their music, whereas before you would tour to promote the music you had already exposed.
Correct. That's correct.
So as you look back, was there a point where, as promoters, you went from kids learning the business show by show to, I think we got it? Was there a particular show?
I don't know the words. I got it is the right thing, but realization that it's a business. That's what I got. And we always kept our mindset pretty much the same. You know, we were lucky to do what we did. People I get calling me today and they go, my son or my daughter or my niece or whatever, they want to get in this business. We talked to them. I said, I'll talk to them, but I tell them not to fucking get in this business.
Right.
Hey, you got Live Nation, you got AG, you got multi-billion-dollar companies. And the guys like me, we were the last independents who did not sell to Live Nation.
Right.
Another company that didn't. And basically, we were the largest independent promoters in the Live Nation era, which makes us either the smartest or the dumbest people. But I didn't want to look in a mirror and see the guy behind me going, you got to make 15% the profits to this, to that.
Sure.
I think my creativity and Jerry's creativity in the things we, you know, helped make, like the World Music Theater out in Tinley Park. It was called the World. And that was named very simply one day. I woke up and went, let's call it something humble like the World. That's how the World Music Theater was named. Now it's sponsored whoever's bank or credit card, but that was the largest outdoor venue ever built, 30,000 people besides stadiums.
When you think back, you got a favorite story about some promotion you had to pull off with an act that, you know, you look back, you just laugh now because it's just, it just worked out great?
No, there is not one. There's probably several.
Give me one of them.
Well, it ended up okay, but when we went to open the World Music Theater, it was about a month or two before we opened, and let's just say it cost X amount of dollars to open the venue, and we had not raised all the money, but we were advertising Cher and whoever we're doing, I can't remember, the Grateful Dead, whoever they were.
Right.
And it's the, now it comes to the day we're opening, people are coming into the arena. We did get the money finally at the last minute, but we didn't have a permit to open. So they come to me and go, Arnie, what do we do? The news is saying we don't have the permit to open. I said, let me talk to them. So I had under my arm, I put a folder, you know, like a manila folder with some paper.
Sure.
And the broadcaster says to me, well, Arnie, do you have the papers? There's rumors you don't have the papers to open the theater. And I just pointed at these papers. They weren't the papers. I said, yeah, I got the papers, you know. And, well, they got the papers. And 20 minutes later, we got the papers and we opened up. And it was a Grateful Dead, yeah.
Yeah. So is there the ultimate truth?
Funny story, no one knows.
Yeah, go.
God, I'm glad I'm this age now. And they can't beat me up. Elton John, Auditorium Theater, mid-70s. We were just starting. We were nobody. We didn't start making it until we were in our 30s, babe. But you said 20s earlier.
Okay.
In the 30s, we haven't started making money because we lived together at that point. And, okay, Elton John was playing the Auditorium Theater. And the agent was a gentleman named Howard Rose. Maybe I shouldn't use the word gentleman, but it was Howard Rose. And he was a big agent, and one of his acts was Elton John. Now, Elton John wasn't the Elton John today, but he was still Elton John. We were Elton John at the auditorium. We're cool. I mean, this is great.
Right.
So I go to him and I say, Howard, we'd like to put WXRT Presents because we can get extra spots. You know, we'd started this radio. He goes, Arnie, just Elton John, no WXRT, just Elton John. Okay, well. Listen, you know, we just starting. This is a big deal for Jam, so we want to put Jam Productions. Arnie, just Elton John, nothing else. I started to ask for something else on the ticket. In those days, it was Ticketron, not Ticketmaster. So he asked me one more question. You're losing the date. Okay. So now I call the Auditorium Theater. They used to print the tickets, not the ticket companies. And so I ordered. And I go to them and say, okay, Elton John, whatever the ticket price was, maybe $50, $70 in those days, whatever. And they said, we'd like to put something about the Auditorium Theater on the ticket. I said, oh, no. Just Elton John, man. Please, nothing else. Well, wait, I said, please, just Elton John. So for the first time ever, I'm breaking this. On the first ticket that was printed, you know what was printed? Right. Just Elton John. I said, stop the fucking press. I'll get killed. They'll never sell me another date. I wish I had one of those tickets.
Oh, just- my God. It'd be so great to be framed on your wall. Oh, fantastic. Who turned out to be, artist-wise, a great surprise? Maybe somebody, I'm not saying you guys were starstruck, but somebody through the years where you thought, this guy's the best. He was just a good guy.
Good guy's different than the best.
Or a band.
I think I would say that I'm going to say something that maybe answers part of your question. James Brown.
Is that right?
James Brown was followed by Michael Jackson, followed by Prince in the manner of the dance, the presentation. And I don't know if you ever saw the movie where James opens for the Rolling Stones.
Sure, of course.
After they played, they said they'll never follow him again. I mean, he was young. Right. I think some of the best performers I've done over 100,000 shows, which just makes me old. And Prince, James Brown, Michael Jackson, the Rolling Stones, the greatest rock and roll band, I think, if you take lights and all the bullshit, and they just play greatest lead I've ever seen. In contemporary more, I think Springsteen, of course. Sinatra.
Is that right? I love that.
Sinatra, loved doing him. The Foo Fighters were really great, great act.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because you get to know these.
Yeah,
you get to know these people through the years, and I know you've had the same experience, but I do it mostly by interviews. And a guy like Dave Grohl is the same guy in conversation that you would have in an interview, off the air, on the air, anytime. Just a good guy. You know, and he gives his mom credit. Well, I had a good mom. So, all right, flip side this for
one, one more. I forgot. Somebody was a great guy. I remember now that you bring it up. Phil Collins.
Oh, that's excellent. You know, he's going through some health things now, so we wish him the best for sure.
I'll tell you a story. If you don't mind, I'll tell you a story that really hit me, and I don't get hit that often. He was playing the United Center as Phil Collins before they came back as Genesis a couple or two, 3 years ago. Who knows when? And he actually thanked me from the stage. No artist.
Sweet.
Yeah, it was, you know, because, you know, it was at the Genesis played at the Kahn Auditorium in Northwestern University in 1972. That was one of our first shows. So he came back as Genesis. Now he's ill. You know, he wasn't great and he had to walk out very slow and he sits down and you're going, oh my God. And then he starts singing and you go, that's fucking Phil Collins, you know.
Yep.
Collins playing the drums. And after the show, crowd's going nuts. And the other Genesis people walk off and Collins is helped off. And as he's walking out, I just happened to be sitting on one of the boxes where the equipment was. And he was walking by and he stopped and turned to me and said, Ernie, how the fuck are you? And that meant a lot.
100%.
Because it was like, which is cool. Nobody.
That's incredible.
But, you know, I've had a lot of, I've been lucky. I met all these people, but they were just in the process of what we did. You know, I know it sounds maybe silly or arrogant or whatever, but it's what we did. It's like, you know, you break music, you play music, you interview all these fucking stars. Well, we've got to hang out with them because when people go places on Rush Street, that was a party place. We didn't go because we were the party.
The town
was the party where we went. The Rolling Stones went, where Aerosmith, we were the party. And, you know,
right.
You know, so it was a different scene. And my wife, Irene, was part of that scene. And I was part of the rock and roll scene. So we were definitely not on the same page.
But you brought the circus to town again and again and again.
That's a good one.
I want to talk to you about what you're doing now, but I also, you and I had a conversation off the air recently about this. The amount of money that's being charged for tickets now is insane. There's a fair number that you can get. Everybody deserves a profit. I'm a capitalist. You're a capitalist. But there's something, and this is the old man in me, there's something about this that just feels like accepted criminal activity. When you have service charges that are insane for a click of a computer and everything that's going on. And it's not just Live Nation or Ticketmaster. Everybody's doing it. And it seems like the artists have no control. Is there anything the artists can do?
There's always something the artists can do. And it's the management and that decides for the artists based on what the artist needs. They need money. Okay, especially in the world that records aren't what they used to be. Remember, it was a mom and pop business when we started, and it's not a mom and pop business. When we started, Ticketron was the big ticket company. Sure. Jam was the first, I believe, it was the first music company to sign up with Ticketmaster back then when it started. And the White Sox, Reinsdorf, was the first baseball team to sign up with Ticketmaster. And they were the replacement for the evil Ticketron. Well, 50, 40 years later, they are who they are, and they are the source of all, a lot of people say evil. I don't, that's what they do. Okay. They're in the ticket business. And I believe, in my opinion, I don't do as many concerts anymore since I left Jam. And I just think it's a ripoff personally. Some of the ticket price, they can be great artists, but how do you be paying? You go with your boyfriend, girlfriend, child, neighbor, whatever, and by the time you leave the arena, it's $2,000 or $1,000, maybe. you know, for two tickets, the parking, concessions, everything else you pay, including the service charge. And you go, what the fuck? That's a, right. I'm just going to a concert. I didn't want to buy the house. I just wanted to rent it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's, now that's me. And whether I have the money or not to buy a show, of course, I don't go to shows, but I know, wait, I'll retract that. I really don't go to shows, you know. When you do shows and everything, you don't go home and start interviewing your wife or whatever, you know.
Right, right. I worked at McDonald's all day. I don't want a hamburger.
Let's go out to a concert. I don't think so. the only way I like to go, the only crowds I like are ones that are paying me.
Sure. It's a business.
Yeah. I went to the Rolling. I'll give you a good example. I went to the Rolling Stones with my wife when they played Soldier Field, maybe last time. And I got in, you know, I got in with all the privileges, went to the soundboard. And at halftime, I stood up and said to Irene, I went, we're leaving. What do you mean? And I looked up at the crowd and I went, no one's paying me to be here.
Exactly.
You know what? I know
I totally get it.
I know it's stupid, but I that's what I do, you know. And it was, they're the best rock and roll band. I love them. And it just hit me home that even that late that I learned something that night too.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, to keep learning. Of every show you've seen, and I make an effort to never ask a cliched question, but I think people would find this very interesting, because most shows you didn't get to see, you're walking around, you're running around, you're answering questions, you're doing whatever. What's the greatest concert you've ever seen? One that you maybe gave yourself at least two or three songs to watch?
Well, I watch two or three sometimes because I got to hang out with the manager or the agent, but,
sure. Yeah, but they're talking to you. One you actually enjoyed.
I would say, probably, no one's asked me that. No, I've never answered that, but I will answer it today. It was somewhere in the East Coast. It could have been New Jersey, Philadelphia, 3000 Theater, and the Rolling Stones were playing there at a theater. Just, they were playing a small theater instead of the big place. And they didn't have all the gimmicks, and then they just played, and I got to tell you, I went as a patron and sat through that whole show, and it made me, that show made me know why I did it, because I'm not a big music fan. I don't listen to radio much. People, I don't want to know that, but I'm not a big music listener. I was in my early days. But that show I remember well, and I remember Led Zeppelin playing at the O2 Arena in London years ago. That was a moving experience. And probably one of the greatest shows I ever experienced, I'm not saying I watched it much, but was the first Farm Aid and Champagne.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Everybody was in that show. And it was, when we're alone, I'll tell you those stories. But,
not bad. Yeah. And Willie at 90, still talking about doing another one.
You know what? Let's just say that I've been in his trailer and, yes. The answer is,
and
yes.
You survived. You survived. You walked out of his trailer. The greatest thing I ever heard about Willie is Snoop Dogg said, I can't keep up with him.
Well, it's true. I'll just tell you that.
Tell me about Grand Slam. Grand Slam, to me, you've been doing this for 10 plus years now. This is more of an experience company, right?
Well, yeah. Why it's called Grand Slam has nothing to do with, well, it does have something to do with baseball. Years ago when I was with Jam and Jam Theatricals, which we started, that was another thing we did when Live Nation came along, because I saw the business changing and I saw that they're a multi-billion-dollar company. We are not. We can't just bully ourselves into whatever, use relationships. That money is the relationship now. Okay, they had it, we didn't. And I would say that, you know what, I think I just lost my train of thought.
Yeah, well, no, that's fine. Listen, my train gets derailed every day. But talking about, don't worry, we'll get some. When your meds and my meds kick in, we're going to be dangerous.
Well, we could talk about that. I forgot what I was going to say, to be honest with you.
No, but it's totally fine. But this experience company that you've created.
Oh, no, I know.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it has something to do with baseball.
So I don't remember what year, but I got in the exhibition business. At first, one of the first exhibitions we did was the body exhibits. It was a huge success. It was, yeah, States. it was the bodies, you know, the body parts stripped of the outside exterior, the bones, the muscles.
Saw it. It was amazing.
And yeah, it was very successful. And how we got to Grand Slam, or how I got there, was I was hired by Major League Baseball and did a Hall of Fame traveling exhibit with the Hall of Fame of Baseball.
Oh, cool.
And so I called it Grand Slam Productions because of baseball. So we had jam theatricals, whatever. And I had this company called Grand Slam Productions. So I kept that alive, and it went away eventually. And then when I started my new company, I had to come up with a name. I already had it paid for, so I kept it.
Sure. What about live theater? Were you guys doing live theater at Jam? You weren't, were you?
No, absolutely we were. Steve Traxler, who worked at Jam Productions with me and Jerry, came to me one day and said, you know, Arnie, maybe we should do theater. And I went, okay, what's that? And he went, right. Went to Broadway and all this. And I said, okay, what's that? And we came up with the idea, probably his idea more than mine, but I'll take credit right now, that we would invest, the first show we invested in was, and it was called Jam Theatricals, by the way, but your public might not know. It became a big business. And when we went to New York, the first show we did was Damn Yankees with Jerry Lewis. And we figured that if we put X amount in, I think it was 25 G's, that other producers would start calling us because we were investors. And they did. But what we did, to our credit, and I got to give him a lot of the credit, was there was a business out there that we absorbed, and it was doing subscriptions, theater subscriptions, like they have in Chicago at the Nederlander Theater, the Schubert, whatever.
Sure.
In 27 markets. So what we would do is get the touring shows. We'd invest a little in Broadway.
Wow.
We had the rights to do the other markets, and that's where the money was made. And we had a formula that worked. I won't go into it, but we had a formula that worked, and we ended up winning 9 Tonys in the process. And don't ask me how, but we did win 9 Tonys.
Where do you keep the awards, by the way? Do you got a house, where a room in the house for the awards?
I just looked at them the other day. Some people were there. What is that? Those are the Tonys? I went, yeah, I think so. Yeah, it is. And there were 3 of them there, and the other 6, I do not know where they are. Steve probably has them.
Oh, wow. And the other part of the experience that you do is, did you ever think you'd be in the circus business?
No, of course not. But many years ago in Chicago, and you might remember this, and maybe your fans will, is that Nick Walenda, the wire walk,
100%.
Walked across the Chicago River.
On a cold night.
Cold night. And then I was called by his manager, Winston Simone. And Winston told me, Arnie, we knew each other. He managed the Beach Boys and some other things. And he went, listen, Nick Walenda wants to walk across 2 buildings like his grandfather did in San Juan when he fell to his death.
Right.
And it was a mayoral election in New York, because they were in New York. And we can't get anybody who will okay this, because he's going to walk over, you know, whatever. He says, can you help me in Chicago? And I went, give me 5 minutes. He says, no, Arnie, I'm serious. I need to know this. I said, give me fucking 5 minutes. He goes, no, Arnie, I'm serious. I hung up on him. I proceeded to call the mayor at that time, Rahm.
Yeah.
And I said, listen, I'm Nick Walenda, wire walk over. You have 100,000 people, be on national TV. Blah, 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 and somewhere in that rap, I said, oh, by the way, there's no net. And there was silence. And I went,
Which, by the way, I know Rahm Emanuel. It's not easy to get silence out of him.
Yeah. No. But there was silence. I thought, this is over. And I said, but they have insurance and da-da-da-da, and we'll pay all the costs and whatever. He said, give me 5 minutes.
And you gave him 5.
I called back Winston, and I said, I'm sorry, it took 12 minutes, but we're a go.
And, amazing.
And he walked over it, and it was a great experience, and we became very good friends. So circus business. Nick was always a performer, but he wanted to be a part owner of a circus. He never owned it. That gave me time. So 4 years went by, and there was a company in New York called the Big Apple Circus, which is huge in New York.
Yeah.
The Art Institute here. Everybody knows the Art Institute. But Big Apple Circus was there 30, 40 years. And we ended up with my partner then, Michael Cole, who's my partner now in New York. We ended up buying the circus and have the Big Apple Circus. And he was a partner. And that's how I got in the circus business. But the answer to your question is no way I think I'd ever own a circus. But there's no way I wouldn't own one, too, that I would or wouldn't.
It's such an amazing life. I mean, we barely scratched the surface. You ever have one that got away? Is there a show you didn't get to do that you wanted to do?
Lots. Oh, yeah, sure. Not many, but...
There can't be lots.
I had to accept the fact when Live Nation came, one of the hardest transitions for me was everybody called me for every ticket in the world in the day we were at top. And when Live Nation came along and people would call me for shows that weren't ours. And that was an adjustment that took me 2 years to get over. Well, it's not ours, but I'd always say, okay, I'll take care of that. And I would take care of it, but I had to wean myself and say, no, it's not my show, you know? But that was the hard adjustment. A show we didn't get, there were lots of them, man, but not too many in the heyday. And then when the Live Nation came along and the cream of the crop, you know, we should do 20 shows at the arenas, whether it be the stadium, the old stadium, or the United Center, or the Rosemont Horizon, which we were the first people to go into Rosemont.
Sure. Horizon.
It had to change, and it did change. And so I'd say almost all the acts that we were friends with.
Right.
To the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is the way it was. So that's why I thought that it was time to go into other, spread out and use the knowledge. I didn't open hot dog stands. Exhibits. Okay. So we did that exhibit, this exhibit. You know, the light show that's up at Botanical Gardens?
Yeah. That's yours.
Started that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, and the thing is, and the thing I love about what you're doing now is I knew if I was going to a jam show, and you know that I was going to see an act that would deliver. I knew I'd have a great night. I never walked out of a jam show and went, these promoters, they don't know what the hell they're doing, because you got it done. Same way with Grand Slam. I mean, you got your name on Grand Slam through the name of the company, and I know it's quality. I hope you're proud of that.
I am. You know what I miss? People ask me, do I miss jam? Of course I miss jam. It was part of my life for 50 years. I love the people that worked there. The people worked for us for 30, 40 years, and Jerry's still doing it, and wish him nothing but the best of luck, unless I'm competing with him. But I don't compete much with him. And we're pretty cool about that. But it was a hard adjustment, for sure. But now I'm proud of what I'm doing. And yeah, it's funny. I got to tell you something funny. When I've done the Rolling Stones, I've done Frank Sinatra. And by the way, I just bought a circus. And they forget about the Rolling Thunder. You bought a circus? It's like that's bigger than doing these huge acts. And I'm amazed by that.
You know, people still call you all the time with the next great idea. You're good to take those calls. As I said, we barely scratched the surface. I know you don't like talking about yourself, but I hope in renewing this relationship that I think we started back in the days of the Loop, that we can talk some more. I certainly love the music your wife is doing, Irene. And even though I do a talk show, we're talking about her music on the air. That's how good that is. But thank you, Arnie. Thank you on behalf of everybody in the Midwest, everybody that ever went to a jam show around the country, because people listen everywhere. Thank you. And thank you to Jerry as well for all the entertainment you provided.
Thank you. But I want to do one thing. I want to say one thing about my wife, please. Irene Michaels. Check her out. She has a new song that Steve and a couple other people have been nice enough to play. It's a really cool song. She had a hit with a song called I Like Rain. She just, at whatever age she is, decided to go back into music, and I give her a lot of credit. And I don't say this much to pitch her more than the overall thing of what I do, what Steve does, and what other successful people do is, I know it's cliche, follow your heart, follow your dream. That's it. It works, folks, and that doesn't always work. And life is not, whoop, it's, you know.
It's a slope.
It's not how much you make, it's how much you don't lose.
Thank you, Ross Cochran, for producing Live from My Office, as always. Thank you, Arnie Granite, and thank you for all the entertainment you all provide for all those years. In the meantime, next time on Live from My Office, if you missed my exclusive with Sammy Sosa on the radio. Don't forget, I'm on the radio every morning from 5:30 to 9. You can listen anywhere, anywhere in the world, on your smart devices. Stream the show. You can probably pick it up on your fillings or your artificial hip. So listen wherever you can. But if you missed the Sammy Sosa interview or you'd like to hear it again, we'll have the full Sammy Sosa interview next time on Live from My Office.
30 years plus on the airwaves, you have turned your dial to me. Now you're tuned into my podcast. It's Live from My Office, Steve. From Ithaca, New York, to Carolina South, W. Cochran, Steve. From Minneapolis, and then Chicago twice, top-rated shows achieved. Sit back, relax, and now listen to my show. When or wherever you are, 'cause you're on the go. A-list celebs with some laughs and great info. Live from my office, the Steve Cochran Podcast Show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No better place to be.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Subscribe and like for free.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Live from my office, Steve.
So glad you're with me. It's Live from My Office, Steve.
Thank you for listening to Live from My Office, a service of Monkey Run Productions. All rights reserved. The podcast is hosted by Steve Cochran, and it's mixed, edited, and produced by me, Ross Cochran. Steve is available for corporate speaking gigs. He would love to MC your event. And occasionally, he's funny. Thank you for listening. Head to CochranShow.com for more.